Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Morin Rout. And today, Marianne, we're looking at fiction in all sorts of forms.
In all its forms, from short, the shortest fiction, and the star of that, Frankie McMillan, who's a genius in that. And then we've got beautiful short stories.
Yep, by Ingrid Horrocks, who has been a non-fiction writer and a travel writer. And now, and has written a really good memoir, which includes swimming, which always brings me in, but now has a collection of linked short stories. And then...
And then we finish with a novel, a crime novel by Fiona Sussman called Hooked Up, and it's about reality TV dating shows. So, but it's fabulous, fabulous read, perfect material for crime.
So let's start with the inimitable Frankie McMillan.
What my mother said to the gunman in the vegetable aisle at Pack and Save. Since my mother no longer rode her bike over the big railway bridge, her scarf coming loose in the billowing smoke, and since she no longer got to Funky Pumpkin, running her hands over the big bins of Coomera, since she was, in fact, at Pack and Save on a Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m, eyeing up the cauliflower heads, while a gunman in a black balaclava told everyone to get down on the floor, since her hips were sore and the floor a long way down, and since the gunman looked familiar, since his red-rimmed eyes looked frantic, since his hand was shaking and the gun was waving like something in a movie, she faced him. "Son," she began. And since a cop who'd been previously fondling an orange in the next aisle was already cocking his trigger, things happened pretty quickly. Shots ringing out and the gunman falling and a pink-haired girl rising from the floor to pull my mother aside. And since the gunman is now in a wheelchair and my mother no longer remembers that terrible day, no one will ever really know what she was about to say to the gunman that Tuesday in the vegetable aisle at Pack and Save.
That was Frankie McMillan reading from her latest collection of stories, Eddie Sparkle's Bridal Taxi. Frankie is very well known internationally and nationally as someone who absolutely knows how to write short fiction in all its forms. She's won many prizes and been published widely for the stories. This is the fourth book from Canterbury University Press, and it's full of your characteristic quirkiness. I hate saying that word, Frankie, because quirky just kind of doesn't really sum it up. Apparently I said there was something called the Frankie-verse, and I hope it was me that said it, because you have a cast of characters who inhabit a world that is just such a delight to visit. Tell me about that story, because you said there are craft things in there that are worthy of chatting about.
Okay, well, like a lot of my stories, there's always a grain of truth, and that little element of truth, it grounds me. So then I feel confident about going on and fictionalising the story. And the story's really about random events that happen. So somebody in the supermarket aisle eyeing up the cauliflower heads, and suddenly there's a gunman ahead of them. When I was crafting this piece, I wasn't, first of all, conscious that I was crafting. I just wanted to get the story out. And when I'm writing, I often tend to use this one long, breathless sentence. And I think it matches the emotional urgency of the subject material as well. It also allows me to sort of get it all out in the one sitting. So I tend to write very quickly and in the one sitting. I've borrowed some poetic elements in this piece. You'll notice that there's a recurring word, since my mother no longer rode her bike, since her scarf. And this since sort of links the story with that recurring word.
And it builds and builds and builds, doesn't it? Because you're dropping another clause or whatever grammatical term it is, you know, which has since this, and you know it's going to build to a crescendo, and then it's wonderful because nobody knew what she was going to say.
Yes. in this piece too, Maureen, I'm also dealing with time a bit. Like, there's a reference at the start that since my mother no longer rode her bike, so we get a picture of a woman who used to ride her bike over the railway bridge, and by the end of the story, she can no longer remember the events of that day. And the same with the gunman. At one time he was, you know, waving the gun. Now he's in a wheelchair. So it's one of the reasons why I like the short form. You can have almost a whole history of somebody in a very short space.
I've been very vague about what it's called, this short form, because, you know, as you know, there's so many different categories, sub-genres of the form. And I don't think you sit down and think, oh, I'm writing flash or I'm writing micro or I'm writing, you know, short, whatever. I guess you probably write the story and take as long as you think the story needs.
Yes, and after a while, it's sort of an instinct, you know, when you're coming to the end of a story. But just to get back to the word thing, flash is more of an American term, short, more of a European term, with a longer history. A lot of 20th century writers write in the short form, Kafka, Gertrude Stein, Hemingway. And here in New Zealand, Janet Frame wrote a couple of pieces in the short form. Notes to the Russian War is really worth looking at.
You teach it as well.
So yeah,
it's
I do.
Not just
I can't get away from it.
No. And your classes are, you know, very popular. And you've taught some wonderful writers of who've gone on to have fame as well with their writing of short fiction or micro or flash / whatever.
Yeah, well, it's very satisfying to see people who haven't had much writing experience and you introduce them to this form. And it seems like a manageable form because it's so short and you can try out a number of different stories in an afternoon. And no big deal if they don't work because you've got another afternoon. Whereas if you're embarking on a novel, that's a huge investment of time. And even a short story, you know, a conventional short story of 5,000 words, that would take me 3 or 4 weeks to do. So it's a good way for writers to learn their craft, and they learn a lot about word economy when they're writing flash because each word has to count. They also learn that you can't have too many adjectives and adverbs in the writing. And there's a strong focus on the one point, which is very good for beginner writers to learn rather than meandering off in all sorts of different directions.
You say you wrote that one quickly and possibly do write these things quickly, but then do you go back over and really hone it down?
Yeah, I get what I call the guts of it out. and then sometimes I'll get a bit obsessive and I'll just stay there tinkering until I've got it. But sometimes I'll go back a day or two later and sharpen it up. Generally, though, within a week I have it. But I have heard of some writers of the short form that go back years later and they're still tinkering with it and still looking at the structure and a bit like poetry, I suppose. Poets tend to do that too.
I know.
Yeah.
It's never finished till it's finished, and then when is it finished?
You spend all morning putting in a comma and all afternoon taking it out.
When you put a collection like this together, are you often surprised at how there are not necessarily themes but links that you weren't aware of that suddenly when you put the body of work together you think, gosh, a lot of horses in here, a lot of birds.
Yeah,
I do. Where did that zebra come from?
I do. It's not until it's all in a collection, though, that I can see that. And I can see that, there's an awful lot of animals in here. And I was thinking about that this morning and thinking that the first stories that were read to me had animals in them, Brewer Rabbit, Brewer Fox, Winnie the Pooh, and also like a lot of baby boomers, I had religious instruction at school and we had these wonderful stories about Noah and the Ark, Jonah and the whale. And, you know, they're pretty unsophisticated, but they still have lodged in me somewhere. I've also, just getting back to the animal thing, I've worked with animals and spent a year milking cows. There's a poem in here about milking a cow. Other things that keep on cropping up in my work of family relationships.
Yes, there's aunts. The mad aunts, groups of aunts. They're usually in a group, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's how I see them. In my childhood, always in a sort of a gang.
Yeah, gang of aunts.
Yeah.
The other person who's turned up here again from some of your other work is Mr. Whippy.
Oh, where did he come in?
In the one about, I was reading it this morning.
Joe Fish, yes. Yes.
And I thought, gosh, there's Mr. Whippy again.
Yes. Oh, well, he's elbowed his way into the collection.
Fish too. I mean, I know they're sort of animals, but there's a different breed of animal when you look at fish. But, you know, in every work it's this humour, and as I was saying before, the humour has so many different levels to it, doesn't it? It can surprise you because it's so unexpected. Where you put people and where you put animals and how stories begin and end.
Yeah, and it's not a conscious thing. I think it's just the way I think.
It is. That's what I mean when there is a Frankie verse.
Yeah.
It's you're never going to see conventional things happening in your stories.
Right, yeah. And people say that they're surreal, and that surprises me too because...
Do you think that they're pretty much grounded in reality, in fact?
Yeah, I do. well, for instance, the Jesus story, I mean, I'm not a Christian, but I know that some Christians do see religious figures. So that doesn't seem to me to be surreal. The angel in the probation officer and the angel, that comes from a painting by a Finnish symbolist painter, Hugo Simberg, called The Wounded Angel. And it's quite a famous painting. And I remember staring at it one day and thinking, God, what goes on there? There was this wounded angel being carried by these two boys on a stretcher. So that's how that story came about. And I suppose it might seem surreal to people, but when you know the backstory, it's a piece of ekphrastic, what we call ekphrastic writing.
So there's always experimentation going on in your work, isn't there?
Yeah, and the short form allows it. I think some experimentation, if it continued, it could get a bit tedious. I mean, in the short piece, past Jack Foo's shop, A Faux Pan Tomb, I think if I'd continued with those repeating phrases that I used there, that, yeah, it just might have been a bit heavy-handed.
Mm.
But in a very short piece, you can get away with that. And you can also get away with sort of making political statements that might seem a bit didactic or a bit heavy if it went on for longer.
Yes. Yeah.
But you can get in and get out. That's another reason why I quite like the form.
Yeah. Do you get delight? You know, do you finish something and feel that sort of joy or delight?
Yeah.
That a reader would?
I feel it when I'm writing it. I feel my most wholesome when I'm writing. And sometimes I'll laugh out loud. but, yeah, I do. I get an enormous amount of pleasure out of writing these short pieces.
And, yeah. They're very visual too, aren't they? They require people to get their imaginations going. I know that probably is in most writing, you, as a reader, you have to imagine yourself into the story. But yours in particular, I think, really strike sparks because you have to see these sometimes quite crazy things going on. And,
yeah.
And that, as I say, can really spark joy in the reader because you've been taken to places that you would never expect to have been taken.
Right, yeah. And I think that's partly to do with the form too, that you get taken to the heart of the matter very quickly.
Mm, mm.
So often these pieces have a bit of an emotional wallop to them because you are taken to the heart so quickly and there is this emphasis sort of on the one thing, often circling the one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're going to read us another piece to end, Frankie.
It's the poem Emily Dickinson's Black Cake. And I'll just say that Emily Dickinson was a famous 19th century poet, and in her time she was more known for her baking than her poetry.
And can I just say there was the most delicious fruitcake at your launch.
Oh, God. Well, I bake a lot of fruitcakes. And I'd always wanted to say that when people asked for the recipe, oh, it comes from my great-great-grandmother. It's a very old recipe. And so this poem is about that. Emily Dickinson's Black Cake. I would like to say my dark fruit cake comes from a recipe handed down from my nanny, who in turn got it from her nanny, whose mother happened to be Emily Dickinson's maid, and not from the Edmonds cookbook, the one everyone has with the building on the cover and the sure to rise slogan over the top, and the awful memory of a man I once kissed, solely because he said he was Mr. Edmonds' grandson and possibly an heir to a vast fortune from tins of baking powder. I would like to say the dark fruit cake I make lasts until Christmas, but it never lasts more than 2 weeks, because my husband and all his relatives are wolves. Lastly, I would like to say, because the food mix is broken, I beat by hand, half crouched with the effort, just like my nanny did, bending over the bowl, pennies stained with brandy, something feral rising in her eye.
Frankie McMillan reading from this amazing collection, wonderful collection of short fiction entitled Eddie Sparkle's Bridal Taxi and published by Canterbury University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
All Her Lives is the intriguing title of Ingrid Horrocks's first collection of short stories. Ingrid has previously written memoir, literary history, and poetry. Last year, she was the writer-in-residence at the IIML, and this year she's about to go to Australia, to the Michael King Writers' Centre, to be the writer-in-residence there. Ingrid, the obvious question to start this off is fiction. What drew you to it? Have you been writing it for ages, or is this a new venture?
Yeah, kia ora. So nice to be here. It took me a long time. So I did write fiction in my 20s, and I did publish a few stories, and, you know, they were in Landfall, and it seemed like I should keep going. But there was something in me that thought I didn't have anything to write about, which I think is quite common for maybe particularly for women in their early 20s. And then at some point in my early 40s, I decided I was going to do whatever I wanted. And it turned out I wanted to write fiction. I've been reading fiction passionately all my life. And short stories is an obvious place to start. I needed to teach myself how to do some things.
Yeah, these are linked in lots of different ways, not obviously, because they don't lead one on to the other, and the times chronologically you've mixed them up. So give us a sense of how it was to structure the book.
Yes, yeah, so from the very beginning, when I realised it was a book, I had this idea of 9 stories, 9 women, 9 different moments in history, and 9 different life stages, which is part of why it took me about 5 years once I had imagined the book to actually write it. And I didn't think they would be linked at first. It's just that I'd written some historical stories and I'd written some contemporary stories, and I wanted to feel how women's lives might echo together across time. But I also didn't want them to be chronological, because I felt as though if I began with Mary Wollstonecraft, which is the earliest story in the 18th century, and we moved forward, I felt as though it would suggest some kind of nice progressive developmental narrative in women's experience. And unfortunately, that didn't seem right to me. So I wanted kind of moments and challenges that were different in different moments. And then the characters started appearing in different stories. So I had a moment when I had Madeline, who is a activist in 1980s Devonport, in one story, and I was starting to write a story about another woman who was older, and I thought, oh, it's Madeline. And then it's this glorious thing that you know someone when they were 26, 27, and then this incredible pleasure about thinking, oh, what are they like when they're 70? And what is the world like, and how is it different? And maybe if I give them that story, what will that feel like?
Yeah, there's a real delight when you, as you're reading through, to realise that you can catch up on other people's stories, and that, you know, comes as a surprise to the reader, which is really, you know, heartening in lots of ways to see.
Yeah, it's-
What became of people?
Yeah, the idea of, I think it is heartening. I think that's a really nice word for it. So I feel like, so there's a peripheral character, May, who's just a young mother in the first story, Evie on Branch. And for me, there was a lovely realisation that she could appear in a later story as this kind of formidable family friend. You think, oh, that's who May is.
And Evie, from that story, you get a little glimpse into what happened to her as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing about a short story, is that it feels so contained. So Evie on Branch, Evie is queer and she's come back to her family farm in 1919. And the story is just one afternoon. And that kind of, you don't know if she'll stay on the farm, what will that will mean for her queer identity, and then you get this little glimpse later on about what might have happened, whether her lover might have been part of her life. And it's kind of joy and the richness of our lives.
I love that opening story, because the way you described her coming home to the farm and seeing it with new eyes after having been at the war as a nurse, there was something, and having grown up on a farm myself, it was just beautifully evoked, the sense of the farm, the physicality of the place.
That it helps that that's actually my farm, essentially, where I grew up north of Masterton. So that I do know that landscape. And that story comes from having seen a set of photographs of farming life in the sort of early 20th century, and this really striking photograph of a young woman sitting on a branch. And it's so beautiful. And I started imagining what was it like for a young woman a century earlier than when I was living on that farm. And also in the photograph, it's very clear that the felling of that farm is happening in that moment. So also what did that landscape and transition feel like, and how isolated it was in the 20th century. But it's also a landscape I both love and I've left.
It comes through, and it's interesting that it was your farm because, you know, there are very strong emotions evoked, as I say, in that story of her coming back. And there are things that are so familiar to her, but things that have changed as well. I have to say, one of the stories that really resonated with me was the one set in Truby King's garden. And because I was brought up as a Plunkett child, had it drummed into me that you couldn't spoil babies. But I hadn't realised I knew what a strong influence he'd had over generations of New Zealanders. But I hadn't realised that he had those views on women's education.
No, and neither did I. So that story started from a sense that there was this garden that has his mausoleum at the centre, and that it had a hospital and it had babies. And so it was sort of a way of thinking about the history of New Zealand women's lives. But the more I read biographies and read some of the quotations from his writing, it's pretty extreme. And then I spent a lot of time in the National Library looking at pamphlets and, you know, some things, very strange ideas, like the fact that blood would be drained from the womb if women did too much thinking. Yes. So we wouldn't, and that it would also is quite deeply linked into eugenics. And so basically white women needed to produce babies and they needed to bring them up in a particular way. So it's really interesting that Plunkett has been trying to sort of remake themselves and has actually publicly talked about this issue with Truby King. But I didn't want to write a story about Truby King, which is why I stepped sideways and I wrote a story about the little girls growing up in the garden.
Yeah, and one of them being really affected by coming across, you know, what he said about women's education, learning, that it would basically destroy them and they had to put it aside and bring up children for the empire.
Yes. And I did want, I was quite shocked reading those pamphlets myself, even though, I mean, we know about the history of sexism.
Yes.
It's sort of just when it's so naked. Mm. I think that's what we're not used to seeing, and the clarity of his views alongside the books that he was writing that were being sent to every mother. So I was sort of imagining what does it mean for a teenager to encounter that? And to have imagined, this story is set in the 1930s, so she's good at school, this girl, Kina, and to have imagined that was considered worthwhile, and then to read these pamphlets written by a man she knows and think, oh, that's what he really thinks.
Yeah. Very shocking, as you say. Tell me about your interest in Mary Wollstonecraft, because I don't know enough about her.
Yes. So she's one of my obsessions since my 20s, really. And so Mary Wollstonecraft is most famous for writing The Vindication of the Rights of Men in the wake of the French Revolution. And then thinking, oh, hang on, wait a minute. And then she wrote The Vindication of the Rights of Women. So it is kind of that foundational feminist text. And I think there are a few things that fascinated me about her. One is that she had this big discussion of reason, and then her life is a complete disaster. So her feelings, I think as a young person, realising that actually life was more complex than setting things up. And also that she's writing in a moment where she thought the French Revolution would change all their lives, and particularly women's. And it didn't. And it didn't enough. And so she's writing in a moment of sort of desolation, both personal and political. And so I'm interested in that. But then once I was writing fiction, I just felt like there was a story in that. So that story, I had to work really hard to find the moment. So it's just 3 days. Mm. Mary Wollstonecraft, sailing around Norway, looking for a lost cargo from a silver ship. And the silver ship kind of becomes the metaphor for what she's lost, which is her love, her kind of political idealism. And at the same time, she's there, it's beautiful, she's embodied, she's strong, she's got this incredible mind, she's missing her baby. So I actually loved writing that.
Yes, again, the place is so much part of that story. As you say, it's beautiful, it's remote, it's surprising to her. And so that, you know, becomes very much part of the story as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. And there is a lot of desolation in the stories, but I also wanted there to be this kind of sense of pleasure, and that these women had these sets of circumstances around them that are putting pressure on them, but nonetheless they're living their lives and they are themselves, and they're in their place. And so I think for me, often the place is part of what provided the consolation and the beauty in the stories.
Yeah.
Which I think is true for a lot of us.
Of course it is. That's why we live where we live. It's why we go to the places we go to. And people like you immerse yourself in water. I do. Yes. I do when the water's warm.
Yeah, it was pretty chilly this morning.
I bet. I have huge admiration for people who swim all year round. I always mean to, but somehow I give up. Now, the other story that I had real resonance for me, because I'd probably around about the same age, was the one set in Devonport, the one, you know, you alluded to at the beginning, of the awakening of a woman to what she could be through, you know, becoming part of a women's group and banning nuclear ships in the 1980s. So,
I'm really pleased you like that, because, you know, that's, in some ways, that's, it's my mother's generation there, and I'm writing into a space that so many people know that time very well. We did live in Devonport in the 1980s, so again, it's an area that I know. But I just love the idea that Devonport has the naval base, and it also had the anti-nuclear movement, and that everyone's kind of living alongside each other. So putting a kind of that story puts pressure on a relationship. So the conservative husband, and then the woman who is actually finding herself through all these other means. And actually, this one, I have to say, this is my Trump story, because I kept thinking, what is it like in America to be in one of those marriages where someone has become obsessed in that space? And how do you live intimately with someone where their political views on the entire world are kind of opposed to yours? And so that was really fun for me to think through that. And I like her husband.
He's a decent guy.
And that took a lot of writing to get there. I don't know that they can live together.
And we get a glimpse of her life again, as you said, later on. So, you know, which is really satisfying.
Yeah, she's. I think she's really amazing, Diana. So we meet her in this little moment where she's not yet strong enough to leave. She's also pregnant with twins.
Yes.
So I had this idea in my mind that even if she thought she would leave, I have twins.
Yeah.
I wouldn't leave. I wouldn't leave. You need a partner. It's helpful to have a partner when you have twin babies. So she needed longer to actually be able to leave. But I think stories can go into the pivotal moment where the mind changes, even if you're not yet ready to change your life.
Yeah, the ending of that story is perfect, really, because it must be hard to decide where the perfect place is to you know, get out. And she gets out of a situation and she realises that things have changed emotionally and mentally for her.
Yes, yes. And also it was important to me that the activists in that story weren't also all good. You know, they're all complex, compromised characters.
Yes, they sure are. Yes, they are in life.
They are. They certainly are. And quite funny. I hope that story's quite funny.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, yes. Yes. Yeah. There's so much in each story that is, you know, rooted in real life, but, you know, real life has humour. Lots of humour, lots of black humour. Just to end, tell us about going to the Michael King Writers' Centre.
Yeah, so actually it's a relationship that the Michael King Writers' Centre in Devonport has with the Varuna National Writers' House in the Blue Mountains. So every year the Michael King Writers' Centre in collaboration with Australian Arts Council, I think, sends one New Zealand writer to the Blue Mountains for a month, and we live in a house with six other writers, I think, which is going to be great because usually as writers we get sent off on our own. And I participate in the Blue Mountain Writers Festival and other readings in Sydney, and I'm writing a novel, and the novel is the story of Diana, the Devonport woman. It's her babies. Her babies all grown up in their 50s in
contemporary
New Zealand. Yeah, yeah. There's going
Boy,
to be
there's to lots to wrestle with there, Ingrid.
There is. I like the big topics.
Oh, well, that's wonderful news. I'm thrilled. I'll look forward to that, and I hope your experience over there will be really useful but inspiring, challenging, all those things.
Yeah, it'll be fantastic. Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you.
Yes, lovely to talk to you too. Ingrid's book is called All Her Lives. There are 9 stories. It's by Ingrid Horrocks, of course, and it's published by Te Heringa Waka Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Hooked Up is a knockout premise. Anyone who feels driven to murder by TV dating shows will be cheering. Plus, the slow burn relationship between lead detective Bandara and Stark is every bit as compelling as the crimes. Now, that's a mashup statement of high praise for Fiona Sussman's latest murder mystery from two of New Zealand's other contemporary most celebrated crime fiction authors, Michael Bennett and Jacqueline Bublitz. Yeah, noir fans are in for a treat, says Bublitz, and I thoroughly agree. Fiona joins us on the show to discuss her 5th novel. She's featured in our Naya Marsh Awards twice and in New Zealand Book Lovers Awards, winning both previously. Her books have been internationally published, and she's also been recognised for short stories. So this, her second career as a writer after dumping general practice in 2003, is going pretty well for her and for us. Hooked Up brings her previous detective duo, Ramesh Bandara and Hilary Stark, back together to solve that most un-Kiwi of crimes that nevertheless haunts all our imagination, serial murder. Tēnā koe, Fiona. Thanks for joining us.
Tēnā koe, Marianne. It's a real pleasure to speak with you.
So, you're not New Zealand born. Give us a little potted history of Fiona Sussman.
I was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, during the apartheid era, and came to New Zealand in 1989, during my medical training, I fell in love with a young Italian doctor, white coat flapping in the wind. He was about to immigrate to a little country somewhere in the Pacific. I didn't even know where it was. I followed him over here, and he took me on the Milford Track, and I fell in love with this beautiful place and went on to complete my medical studies here. And I've been in New Zealand now going on 35 years, even though my accent sounds as though I arrived the other day.
Well, kia ora, kia ora, it's lovely to have you, and we'll claim you as a Kiwi author. So now, interviews for murder mysteries are tough, Fiona. I don't think I'm giving away too much with a quote from Michael about dating shows, right? Because even the cover synopsis lets that cat out of the bag.
Indeed.
Okay. But it's the fitting it all together that's the magic, right? So tell us about being a crime writer and the pleasure of doing that.
Well, the premise of Hooked Up is essentially what starts off as a simple, supposedly simple homicide set in Mangawhai, up in this lovely little coastal town north of Auckland. And it's Ramesh Bhandara, who is the same detective we saw in The Doctor's Wife, is sent up to try and solve another crime. And seems to be an absolute dearth of leads, and he's beginning to wonder whether this is going to be the first perfect murder of his career, when his colleague Hillary notices some rather tenuous connections with a case she'd worked just out of police college. And they dig a little deeper and find that the connections between these two unsolved murders are in fact quite solid. Both victims had participated in a dating reality TV show some 10 years earlier. And overnight, the investigation really tilts from a single homicide into something into high stakes territory, really, where all the cast and crew of this beleaguered reality TV show fall onto the suspect list as well as potential victim list. And so it is exciting. It's crime writing is something I fell into. It's not something if you'd said to me 10 years ago that I would become a crime writer, I wouldn't have believed you. But my first two novels were social justice novels. I wrote my first one set in apartheid South Africa, and then the second one navigating the underbelly of New Zealand. And the second one won the Niall Marsh Award, which for best crime novel. And I was, of course, delighted, but a little bit taken aback, because I had conceptualized of it as a social justice novel. But it was as a result of this award that I got to go over to Bloody Scotland, this amazing crime writing festival that is held in Stirling. And it was there that I discovered the amazing breadth of writing that falls under the banner of crime fiction. And I was so warmly embraced by the community there that I thought, I need to come home and try my hand at a traditional crime novel. And so that's where The Doctor's Wife came from, and now Ramesh and Hillary into their second investigation.
Oh, that's a wonderful backstory. Thank you so much for sharing that. So Bloody Scotland. Bloody Scotland is that as a result of the Niall Marsh Award, is that part of the prize pack for...
It was for that particular year, not so much. It was just there had been an arrangement. It was going to be an exchange of writers. And I think it was Dame Denise Mina came out to New Zealand.
What a great year to win. What a great absolutely. Year to win. How wonderful. And we're all enjoying it. All of us crime fiction fans are enjoying it. I think one of the things here is that your characters and mystery, they both, the kind of intrigue and the characterization, they do equal work. And I think you've just given us a clue that murder wasn't always your kind of what you wanted to write about. You write about people, and that comes through really strongly. So I'm interested about it, you keep turning the pages hungrily, but we all do get a lot of character depth. So it's a lovely balance. Talk to me about that. Tell us about how you find that balance.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think you sort of hit the nail on the head when, in some ways, I've reconciled what I was hoping to, well, in fact, my two disparate professions, as it were, you know, medicine and writing, I came to, I guess, from the same place, and that was an interest in the human story and possibly somewhat naively hoping to do some good. I'm sort of aware of even the power of the pen, even if you're telling an entertaining crime novel. And so for me, character is very important. I'm writing about what I think are very ordinary people. You know, they're not glassy-eyed or milky-eyed James Bond villains. They are people we might meet on any given day. And what I'm fascinated by is what sort of personality traits and social stressors might steer someone into forbidden territory. And so I guess, and I think that for any, you know, crime writing is no different to any other novel. Readers need to be able to buy into a character, to invest in that character and follow their journey. And so character needs to be well balanced with plot. You need both to, it doesn't really matter how clever your plot is, but if readers don't really find your characters credible or people they want to follow, then you're going to lose them along the way.
Mm. Okay, so that's we certainly don't do that. We find the people beautifully written and subtle. Not, you know, as you say, they are people that you feel like you could meet. The chemistry and kindness between Bandara and Hillary in particular is a real strength. So we can believe in our villains and in their motivations, but it's that chemistry and friendship between those two. He's very gentle, wise. He's carrying a load, right? And for listeners and watchers, as well as readers, you know, people who listen and watch TV, the lead detective has Sonny Khan vibes, I think, from TV's Unforgotten. Do you think Bandara's got Sonny Khan vibes? Is that a fair statement?
Yes, look, I'm not hugely familiar with it, so I probably shouldn't say that.
Okay, sorry. So anybody who is, it's a great show. It's as good as this book, and it makes me feel amateurish for asking, but is it nerve-wracking writing a central character of a different ethnicity and gender? You know, so it's not your profession. Yes. It's not, yes. You know, it's not your ethnicity. It's not your gender. How do you get them to feel so kind of authentic?
I guess I've always wanted to have diversity in my books. You know, for me to write about white middle-aged woman, you know, would be very boring. And so I always think that writers need to write about what moves them and characters that move them, so long as they do that with sort of respect and dignity. And so that may involve doing some additional research. But I do tend to really, on my good days of writing, I'm completely in that character's skin, navigating the world that they would navigate. And on other days, I'm a writer sitting back thinking I'm a writer writing a character. And those are the days when writing's not quite as effective. But people have often said, oh, do you bring specifics of your medical career into your writing? And I have never done that. But I think looking back, what medicine afforded me was I learned a lot about human nature, because when people are unwell, they're at their most raw and honest. So, you know, you have this enormous privilege of traveling alongside them when they are really, you know, stripped of all artifice. And so I hope that that's what I can import and bring to all my different characters. But it is always a question. I would never want to cause any offence. And, for example, I have a very dear Sri Lankan friend, and I always joke, I say 0800 Sri Lanka, because if ever I needed to check on something about Ramesh, I would just pick up the phone and ask her.
Yeah, okay. That's beautiful. And you'd get that about being a GP, the insight that it gives you into so many people and their lives. And that comes through. So just switching tack then, this whole dating show thing, okay, I think it's a key indicator of a generational gap. I'm definitely so on the other side of it somehow. I'm constantly surprised by how even young people who are like full of purpose and intelligence and creativity, but they've got this like low-grade addictive indulgence around dating shows. What is it? What is it with dating shows?
Absolutely. I mean, we seem to have this insatiable hunger to almost, well, for real-time drama. And it's almost as though it's like sort of, Schadenfreude, like on steroids, where we almost want to watch other people who we can in some way relate to implode. I don't know what it is. I found it quite distressing in the research I did for the book. And, you know, it is. I think that it's got a lot to answer for. I'm looking at sort of one small section, and really that's the duty of care that producers have to the contestants. But I do wonder about the wider picture, even what it's teaching us about relationships
and all the social media kicking off around the show as well, and nasty, nasty things. I mean, not that you go into that so much, but, you know, that's what it's like. This world is quite dark. You have a great quote at the front of the book that you've included about watching the circus in Rome. And I can't, but, you know, are you entertained watching the circus in Rome? It's a great quote for that reality TV aspect. Maybe it's always been part of our culture and we're just letting it have freer reign.
That's right. I mean, I think it's Maximus in Gladiator, and Russell Crowe sort of looks up, you know, he's just felled a number of his fellow contestants, and he says to the emperor, "Are you not entertained?" And I guess it spoke to two aspects of the book. The one is this idea of how we almost sacrifice contestants in the name of ratings and in the name of entertainment. And the other aspect of it is really that books are also there to entertain, and I mean it in the widest sense, even if some of the subject matter is quite dark. So it's also about taking the reader on a journey.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things is getting that match of kind of detective skills. They feel like really credible as well, the leaps that they make. Nothing's too tenuous, and they're well matched across Hillary, Chris, and Bandara. You know, you've got a team there that's functioning nicely. How did you find out how detective teams work, and what makes magic in a detective team?
Yes, well, certainly I needed to do a fair bit of research, and that involved even, for example, doing a forensic workshop with a former Scotland Yard and Metropolitan Police forensic scientist. It's really interesting, I think, that readers of crime are incredibly savvy readers. You know, they listen to a lot of true crime, they read a lot of crime. And so to make a story convincing, you have to be credible. So, you know, do not introduce a gun if you do not know how it works. And so from that point of view, I did a significant amount of research. I also read former detectives' work, books that they had written about their time in the force. And then, of course, there's the wonderful bit of a little bit of one's own imagination thrown in as well.
Good stuff. There's one thing that doesn't feel very authentic. I'm sorry, I've got to say it. Okay, Gavin is such an excellent plot device. I love him. He definitely needs his own fan club. This is the police dog, the police dog who's failed police academy. He's gorgeous, but none of my friends would babysit my dog. Just saying. So I'm not sure that that's 100% believable. I don't know. Do your friends babysit your dog?
Look, we got our very first boxer by somebody who said, "Would we please look after them and see how we went with the dog?" And I'm sure that Harry was actually drugged at the time, because he seemed very well behaved for a week until we finally sealed the deal. But yes, I mean, I have a great love for dogs, and I just rather like the, you know, we know that Hillary is the socially awkward, sort of brusque character who really sort of brings some practicality to Ramesh. But she's carried significant trauma in her life and has actually benefited hugely from having animals of some sort in her life. And I really do have that, you know, the more I see, I'm around dogs and animals, the more I think they have this magical ability to sort of bridge a gap that sometimes humans don't. And so Gavin really fills that role for me.
Yes, no, he truly does. And yes, Hilary's childhood trauma and the re-traumatization, you know, gives a lot of depth to the story. So well done. I was really taken by the super endorsements from Jacqueline and Michael. The beautiful, intelligent comments about the book, of course, as crime writers. And it's like there's a really supportive club of great New Zealand crime writers. Are you all mates?
We are. It is just lovely. It's something that I think due to no small measure, Craig Sisterton, who is actually a former lawyer who an amazing sort of aficionado on all things to do with crime writing, he began the Niall Marsh Award. And it seems to me you know, not just in New Zealand, but everywhere, that the crime writing community is very supportive. I think partly that was why, even when I went over to Bloody Scotland, I had been so warmly embraced by the community there. I thought, this is really appealing. And certainly we have an amazing selection of really great Year Noir authors in Auckland and the rest of New Zealand. And we are all good friends. And there's that sort of sense of just because one person's book is good, it doesn't mean there's not room for another person's great book. So it's lovely.
I'm sure, and that really comes across, but I'm wondering, is there any trace of a bitchy, dark, competitive side to it that could be the stuff of a good crime novel?
Now you're talking. I might have to.
those awards are so sought after, aren't they? Is there a sense when you're writing, if you don't get on that list, are you gutted?
To be honest, when I'm actually writing, I never really think beyond my study, which is interesting. Maybe I should be, but I'm always you spend 2 or 3 years sort of sequestered away on your own with just your characters for company. And then when a book comes out, you know, you suddenly burst into the light and you have interviews with Queen. And I'm always sort of staggered that there are other people who are actually reading my books. So I don't ever think in terms of the awards. It's always a wonderful boost if one receives one. But I think it's really important to remember that it's subjective, it's on the day or sort of in the year, and to not let oneself get because it's quite, writing is full of self-doubt. And so these things certainly help with validation, but I think one's got to guard against not going the other way if you don't win it.
Sure. And look, there's so much great crime fiction, and this is right up there amongst it. I just did think that award setting, you know, we might explore the dark side of crime writers, could be a lovely farce. Anywho, the book is Hooked Up. It's by Fiona Sussman. It's published by Bateman Books, and it is a ripping good read. Thank you so much for joining us.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.